Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. President Obama and Chief Justice John Roberts were forced to redo the oath of office after the 2008 inauguration because they stepped on each other's lines. Roberts had memorized the oath and was apparently thrown off by the president's timing. This was a first, and it's where Jeffrey Toobin begins his new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Toobin goes on to write about the inner workings of the Roberts Court, the personalities and philosophies of the justices, and the debates over key decisions, including Citizens United and this June's ruling that upheld the Affordable Care Act. Jeffrey Toobin also examines the parallel lives of the president and the chief justice and how their judicial philosophies differ in surprising ways. I should note that Senator Obama voted against John Roberts' appointment to the court. Jeffrey Toobin writes about lots of things, including many legal things for The New Yorker. He's also senior legal analyst at CNN and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Jeffrey Toobin, it's been a while. Nice to have you back on the show.
Hi, Marty.
Well, let's begin with the Affordable Care Act. And you and others, when you heard the arguments, frankly, got it wrong. You said this was a train wreck.
And I don't think it's precisely right to say that. I would say I got it completely wrong.
Okay,
not just wrong, completely wrong. Yes. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay. But perhaps misreading what the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, what his argument was or the way he argued that case for the president?
Well, I have groveled in appropriate apology before Don Verrilli and others. Just to set the scene, remember that all through the legal proceedings leading up to the Supreme Court, the critical issue was, did the Commerce Clause of Article 1 of the Constitution justify Congress in creating the individual mandate, the requirement that people buy insurance? Much of the argument, virtually all of it, focused on that question. And the questioning from the five conservatives on the court was very hostile to Don Verrilli. And, you know, I didn't think Verrilli did the greatest job, but to me, the questions are always more important than the answers because that's where you get to know where the justices are thinking. A very subsidiary argument mentioned only in passing was that the taxing power of Congress also justified the Affordable Care Act. As it turned out, Chief Justice Roberts, in a surprise to many, but especially me, wrote the opinions justifying the law under the taxing power.
And I do want to pick up on all of that, but I remember hearing Verrilli, who's a seasoned lawyer, Solicitor General, his opening remarks. And it was so fascinating because he was sort of hemming and hawing and coughing and sounding like a kind of a nervous novice.
He had a bad day. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Don Verrilli had argued a lot of cases in the court, but he had never argued a case of this magnitude. And look, we're all human, and, right. and he had a bad day. I think, you know, one of the things that becomes clearer in retrospect, I mean, let me just step back for one second.
Okay.
One reason why I find these arguments so interesting at the Supreme Court, and this goes back to Chief Justice Rehnquist. Chief Justice Rehnquist had a philosophy. He thought good fences made good neighbors. The justices really leave each other alone to a great extent. And under the Rehnquist Court, the justices started using oral argument as a way of trying to convince each other of their positions. They used their questions as arguments. So it was not just my stupidity that got it wrong. It's that, you know, having watched a lot of these arguments, they don't tend to play devil's advocate. What the views they express tend to be their own. And the irony here is what they expressed about the Commerce Clause is what they wound up ruling about the Commerce Clause. What didn't occur to me was how much the taxing power mattered.
And again, we'll get to that, but would it be fair to say that the liberal justices were helping Verrilli out?
Doing their best, absolutely.
Doing their best to try to some damage control, perhaps?
Well, Ruth Ginsburg was so frustrated at one point with Verrilli's argument, she literally said, well, what you're trying to say is X, Y, and Z. I mean, she really just sort of restated the argument in what she found a more persuasive way.
But using then this case as an example, would it be fair to say that the justices have made up their minds before they hear a case actually argued before them?
You know, I've asked many of the justices that question. I say, well, how often does oral argument change your mind? they say two or three times a year.
Really?
I mean, not very often. I mean, they like oral argument. They like the idea, you know, the cases become clearer, especially in lower profile cases where the issues aren't as familiar. But very much the case in these big cases is that they know how they're going to vote going in.
And so that must be make an I'm not sure if onerous is exactly the right way to describe it. But then does it become a kind of kabuki theater? Then so you've got lawyers going through the motions, and you've got justices asking questions to sort of score points with each other.
Yes, I think that's a little harsh. Perhaps I do think that even when you know how you're going to vote, there are many ways to write a Supreme Court opinion, and the argument can sharpen one point or another, or focus one issue or another. But it is true. Mm-hmm. That 9 times out of 10, you can walk out of an oral argument and know how they're going to vote. This was one of the ones, not one of the nine.
Well, let's go to Chief Justice John Roberts, and it was 4-4. That, I guess, was the original vote before they began, I guess, their deliberations. Why was he persuaded by this tax argument, do you think?
Well, this question of why is always the toughest question I have in as a journalist. Because if you ask a Supreme Court justice, why did they rule in a certain way, they'll always say, well, I was just persuaded by that argument. And Chief Justice Roberts would say and has said, look, I just was persuaded that the taxing power was the appropriate and winning argument. I think the truth is a little more complicated than that. I think Roberts saw the Obamacare case as the third in a trilogy of cases, starting with Bush v. Gore in 2000, Citizens United in 2010, Obamacare in 2012. The first two, 5 Republican justices trashed dreams of Democrats. This, had Roberts ruled the other way, would have been 5 Republican justices doing it again. And I think Roberts, though he remains a very conservative Republican, is someone who cares deeply about the institutional reputation of the Supreme Court, who doesn't want to see the Supreme Court as just another group of Democrats and Republicans fighting. And I think the idea of showing the world that party lines sometimes can be crossed in these big cases was appealing and important to him, and I think that was a big factor in his vote.
That's interesting, because it's such a political decision to make.
You know, the justices always try to say that they are divorced from politics, but give me a break. You know, these are intensely political decisions, and at some level, they all know it.
And should we think of them as 5 Republicans and 4 Democrats? I mean, is that a fair way to think of the Supreme Court?
You know, there are lots of interesting facts about the Supreme Court. There are 6 men and 3 women. There are 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. There are 6 products of Harvard Law School and 3 products of Yale Law School. But the most important number about this court is 5 Republicans and 4 Democrats. That is overwhelmingly the most significant fact about this court, and it will tell you the result in almost every case.
Scalia was, as you write and as others have said, infuriated by Roberts' decision.
He was, and the other conservatives were very disappointed too. I think it's also important, you know, to recognize that, you know, these justices are all repeat players, and they know it doesn't pay to hold grudges, because you're going to need these votes in the future. So yes, Scalia was angry, but when they come back in a couple weeks for the first Monday in October, Scalia will be back at work, and nobody's going to be grumpy, and everybody's going to be hopeful about the new year. So yes, he was angry, and yes, he was disappointed, but you know, I think they all recognize at some level that being a Supreme Court justice means losing sometimes.
You describe sitting in the court when the decision was being read. I think you were sitting next to Senator Orrin Hatch, who had a very visible response to this ruling.
One of the great privileges of being a journalist is to watch history unfold, and This was, I thought, a unique moment in American history because, you know, unlike so much in American life, there were no polls. There were no hints. Sure, there were so-called experts making their uninformed opinions about what would happen. Mm-hmm. But when John Roberts and the 8 of the, others came out from behind the red curtain, no one knew. And as Roberts started talking, the first issue he addressed was the Commerce Clause, and he and he said the Commerce Clause did not justify the Affordable Care Act. And it appeared at that point that he was about to strike down the law. And I happened to be sitting right across from Senator Orrin Hatch, and a lot of this, and Michelle Bachmann was there, a lot of Washington celebrities were there. And Hatch was beaming. He thought this was the end. But then Roberts took the turn and said there is an alternative justification offered, and he did uphold the law under the taxing power, and I saw Senator Hatch's face fall. But, he's a pro, too, and he knows that sometimes you win, sometimes you lose.
But was Robert saying to the conservatives that, because they wanted to overturn the whole thing,
of course,
that they were going to overplay their hand?
Well, I think that was one of the factors that led to the decision. The four other conservatives, Scalia, Kennedy, Alito, and Thomas, they didn't just strike down the individual mandate, in their view. They wanted to get rid of the whole law, including parts that everyone agreed were constitutional. They said the unconstitutional parts were so bound up with the unconstitutional parts you couldn't tell them apart, and Congress had to figure it out. That would have been such an extreme step. That would have been such a disruption in American politics, in American law, in the American economic system. I think it caused Roberts considerable pause. And if those four had simply said, well, we just want to strike down the individual mandate, I think there's some chance they would have gotten Roberts' vote.
Was this a conservative decision that Roberts made when he said the idea of a mandate is built on this idea of a tax and Congress has the power, the authority to tax people? I mean, is that a conservative idea?
Well, I think your question really illustrates the change in the meaning of the word conservative, especially at the Supreme Court. And this is a theme that I talked about in The Nine, my previous book, and that I certainly explore a lot in The Oath, which is that what it meant to be a judicial conservative for a long time was judicial restraint, which was let the political processes work. Right. You know, if the people of a state want to ban abortion, let them. Don't interfere. And it was the liberals who were the judicial activists who overturned the will of the people. One of the great changes of modern conservatism, especially at the Supreme Court, has been the growth of conservative judicial activism, which is, you know, overruling the elected branches of government, whether it's gun control. You know, the people of Washington and Chicago, they wanted gun control. Congress said, you can't do it. Congress passed the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, and Citizens United, they said, you can't do it. But here, Roberts went back to the old model of judicial of conservatism, which was judicial restraint deferring to the elected branches of government.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Jeffrey Toobin. As he mentioned, he wrote a book a couple of years ago about the U.S. Supreme Court titled The Nine, and his new book is called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. We're going to take a very short break. Much more to talk about. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The theater at Raritan Valley Community College supports WHYY and presents An Evening with Fran Lebowitz, Saturday, September 29th at 8 p.m. The cultural satirist and chronicler of the Me Decade will offer insights on timely issues such as gender, race, gay rights, and the media, as well as her own pet peeves including celebrity culture, tourists, and strollers. Tickets and more information to An Evening with Fran Lebowitz online at rvccarts.org.
As cold weather approaches, homeowners need to be careful not to accidentally invite vermin to nest nearby. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to keep the dreaded rat far, far away. Plus, a troubling new trend in genetically modified plants and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Nelly Furtado has sold millions of records with tight beats and fun lyrics, but with her latest project, she hopes to connect with fans on a more spiritual level.
I want the music to do something to the listener, and I think that's what I strive for when I'm in the studio.
Nelly Furtado tells us more about her new album, The Spirit Indestructible, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Jeffrey Toobin is our guest. He's been writing about legal affairs for The New Yorker for almost two decades. He's been a senior legal analyst at CNN for about a decade. And he's got this new book we're talking about called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, with a picture of the president and the chief justice on the cover. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Picking up on this decision on the Affordable Care Act, you really say Roberts' opinion will be very influential looking forward, a significant long-term gain for the conservative movement.
Perhaps. I say that. Ever since the New Deal, Congress has essentially had a blank check from the Supreme Court. If you want to regulate in the economic sphere, if you want to have a minimum wage, if you want to regulate the economy, you can't. One of the more recent goals of the conservative movement has been to try to rein in Congress's power, saying that the Commerce Clause is not a blank check. And Roberts wrote an opinion saying that it's not that effectively just that the Congress has to be aware that there are limits on its power of regulation. And his opinion in this case is very much a step in that direction. Now, if you look at our current politics with the Republican House, they're not exactly in the business of passing a lot of laws regulating the economy. So I don't know how much immediate practical effect it will have. But it is certainly a warning to Congress, don't overstep your bounds.
You write about, and I know you interviewed a lot of people who work on the court and for the court, including interesting comments from former Justice Souter, who found the Bush v. Gore broke his heart, as you write. He also, and I guess I'm quoting you, perhaps quoting him, abhorred the views of Roberts and Alito and was concerned about what the Republican Party was doing to the court.
Well, you know, one of the themes of the oath is really a theme about American politics. Yeah. And if you look at the last three justices to leave the court, Sandra Day O'Connor, David Souter, John Paul Stevens, have one thing in common. They were and are moderate Republicans who are completely alienated from the modern Republican Party. The moderate Republicans who have disappeared from the United States Congress, most famously and most prominently your own Arlen Specter, who I had the privilege of covering a great deal during his long Senate career, they used to be incredibly influential in Washington, on both sides of First Street, in the Congress and at the Supreme Court. Going back to the 1960s, you had moderate Republicans like Potter Stewart, like Lewis Powell, like Harry Blackmun, and then, of course, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor, enormously influential. But there are no more moderate Republicans on the Supreme Court. The current Supreme Court reflects the modern Republican Party, and that is... I think symptomatic of how our politics have changed.
Looking at the Democrats on the court, would you describe them as liberal or moderate? How do you
I'd
see their
I'd say it is tempting to sort of see a balance that I don't think is actually there, that the Democrats have moved left as the Republicans have moved right. That's not true. And if you look at Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, they are very much in line with Clinton and Obama, the presidents who appointed them. Definitely more liberal than the Republicans, but relatively moderates. There's no Thurgood Marshall. There's no William Brennan on that court. There's no Abe Fortas, William Douglas, these real crusading liberals. They are moderates. They are liberals. They are going to vote to uphold Roe v. Wade. They are going to vote to allow affirmative action. But they are not trying to remake the country in some liberal direction.
Let me go back to when John Roberts was before the Judiciary Committee. He talked about, he said he saw the job as like an umpire calling balls and strikes. Now, several years later, would that be how you describe his judicial thinking on the court?
Certainly not. The aggressive conservatism that we associate with Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas is really very much Chief Justice Roberts' view as well. The Affordable Care Act to the side, which I continue to view as an aberration. But if you look at his views on any sorts of civil rights cases. He is really determined to end any sort of racial preferences. They are cutting back on the right to abortion, and Roe v. Wade is still one vote away from being overturned. Citizens United is a dramatic change in American politics and how we finance it. And in all sorts of procedural issues, the court is moving in a more corporate rather than a more individually focused direction. And that's very significantly due to Chief Justice Roberts.
I don't remember all the details or the specifics when he talked about precedent. You have a chapter in this book called The War on Precedents. Is that how you see the court operating?
Yeah. I mean, Citizens United was a classic example of overturning two very recent Supreme Court decisions. In abortion, on the so-called partial birth abortion case, they overturned a five-year-old, effectively overturned a five-year-old precedent. This coming term, they are going to be looking at a case involving racial preferences in admissions to the University of Texas, which very much threatens and may well overturn Justice O'Connor's famous decision from 2003 regarding affirmative action at the University of Michigan Law School. This is a very aggressive conservative majority.
Would it be fair to say that when someone is before the Judiciary Committee and they're peppering them with questions about how they might rule or what their judicial philosophy is, that is a kind of kabuki theater?
Well, I think that is a much more fraudulent process than the Supreme Court arguments. I mean, I really do think Supreme Court arguments are valuable and interesting and important. I mean, the post Robert Bork judicial nomination process has been an exercise in saying as little as possible, and I don't want to be overstate and say just actively misleading, but really in saying nothing in a comforting way. Which is too bad.
It takes a certain kind of skill to do that.
John Roberts is nothing if not an extremely skillful answerer of questions.
And we should say that then Senator Obama voted against Justice.
He did.
But for political reasons.
Well, for political reasons, but also with some reluctance. Because Obama is far less liberal on judicial issues than many people might suspect.
In fact, and it's interesting, on the cover you've got the president and the chief justice, the question being, you know, which one is the conservative and which one is the activist?
Right, and that's, I mean, that is, again, a big theme of the oath, which is that Roberts is much more interested in judicial change than Obama is. And Obama's very cautious approach to the courts, and you know, he's made two fine Supreme Court appointments, but he has not even tried to fill all the vacancies on the federal, the lower courts, and has never given a speech on the subject. This is not something that someone who has been such a beneficiary of the civil rights movement you might expect from him, but this is who he is.
And also Harvard Law School, you know, taught law.
Taught constitutional law. I mean, you know, that is – it's not because Obama is ignorant. That is quite not the case. It is that he believes that political change comes from politics, not from courts. And he has really governed accordingly. It is not like he's just forgotten about it. This has been a conscious choice.
There's something like 70 or 80 openings in the lower courts. Why do you think he hasn't been more proactive in filling those seats?
Well, in fairness to the president, he's had a busy 3.5 years. He came in with an economic collapse, two wars. There were a lot – and he wanted to change health care. So, I mean, he had a lot on his plate. He thought that his other priorities were more important, and a president only has so many shits to play. But that still doesn't explain why he couldn't fill all the seats. I think it was simply a matter of priorities. He didn't want to devote the time and attention to it. And I think that's just revealing about who he is. Now, I should also add that the Republicans, who have a very different approach here, who care about the courts a lot more, have been enormously obstructionist of the appointments he has made. But he could have gotten more through if he paid more attention to it.
And that's Jeffrey Toobin, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, various decisions in the last couple of years. And his book is called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just ask you about Citizens United, an extremely important decision. I think one that we're seeing the effects of as we're in the middle of this presidential campaign. Would it be fair to say, if you boiled it down, corporations are people too? Is that what the court was saying?
That's only part of what they were saying. In fact, the more important message of Citizens United is that money is speech. Because, you know, corporations, I think, mostly tend to be kind of cautious, especially public corporations. They don't always want to get involved in a lot of big political fights. They don't want to have boycotts. There are a lot of Democrats out there, a lot of Republicans out there, and they all buy shoes and they all shop. And so the corporations don't want to necessarily get into those sorts of fights. But the more important message is that money is speech, because if you really believe that money is speech, the entire structure of campaign finance is on the verge of falling down. So, you know, people say, is Citizens United, is, you know, will it be cut back? No, it's going to be expanded with this Supreme Court. Because, you know, why should individuals be limited in how much they can give to campaigns if money is speech? Why can't so why do you need super PACs at all? Why can't Sheldon Adelson just give $10 million directly to the campaign? Doesn't that interfere with his ability to express his First Amendment views? So that is I think, even more significant than corporations as people.
And that goes all the way back to Buckley-Vileo. I mean, wasn't that what the court decided? And that, of course, was, I don't know what the date was, but certainly decades ago.
1974, I believe. Right. Yeah, Buckley versus Vileo, very strange, long, confusing opinion, which really sort of set the template for how the court looks at First Amendment campaign finance issues, and has, in simple terms, made a big mess.
But what's interesting is that there are civil libertarians. There aren't a lot of them, but there are some of them who actually support Citizens United. The idea that, you know, the more speech, the better.
That's right. And one of the lawyers in Citizens United was Floyd Abrams, who is a famous First Amendment lawyer, who represents the press a great deal. And you know, it is also true that, you know, I think a lot of liberals, they make fun of the idea that corporations are people. You know, the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer, they need the First Amendment. They need the First Amendment to do their work, and they're corporations. So they do have certain rights. But what the court had done previously is said, look, you know, yes, it's true that corporations have certain rights, but they are not exactly the same as people. They have, and the court has, instead of taking that middle line, they seem to, the court is moving towards a completely view that people and corporations are identical, and that would be a major change.
And is that the mess that you were referring to?
That's one of the messes. I think money as speech is an even bigger mess.
Because the more money you have, the more speech you have?
That's right. I mean, you know, the Congress in 1907 passed the first law banning corporations from giving money to campaigns. And you know, that, I think, recognized that, you know, corporations are so powerful and have so much money that it is appropriate to regulate their speech in some way. That was undisturbed for decades. What makes Citizens United so dramatic in its change is that it is throwing all those cards up in the air again and suggesting that any sort of regulation of campaign finance is a violation of the First Amendment. And that would be a big change in American life.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Matt from Deptford joining us on Radio Times. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Great fan of the show, and Jeffrey Toobin. My question is this. Wondering if you have any sense if the Supreme Court will take up any cases relevant to same-sex marriage, and if so, what your predictions for rulings would be.
Knowing your track record on predictions.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Thank you, Matt. Sorry about
Don't
that.
Don't go with me to the track. The Well, there are two possibilities, and they're actually very different, and both are likely to be up for consideration by the court this year. The first is the Defense of Marriage Act case, where the First Circuit in Boston declared the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional. And in simple terms, what the Defense of Marriage Act said was the federal government will not recognize same-sex marriages even in states where it's legal. And, so the IRS won't recognize it. And that case is ready to go. The other case is the Proposition 8 case out of California, which basically said the Constitution says that gay people have the same right to get married that straight people do. I think the court is much more likely to take the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act case, and I think the same-sex marriage plaintiffs are much more likely to win that case because that is a much more modest step. The Defense of Marriage Act only applies in states that already have same-sex marriage. Mm. So it's not a question of imposing it on the country. If the Proposition 8 case goes up there, the justices will be confronted potentially with the question of, do we force the 44 states that don't have same-sex marriage to start offering it? That is a politically very dicey situation and could lead to an enormous backlash against the court, even if they thought that the law required it. So I think the court will take the DOMA case, will overturn DOMA, but I think they will not address the Proposition 8 case. They will simply let the Ninth Circuit decision stand. Same-sex marriage will come to the whole state, but mostly San Francisco. That will mean that approximately 20-25% of the country will live in places where there is same-sex marriage. And I think the Supreme Court will let that play out over a few more years before they address that specific question.
Matt, thanks for the call to Radio Times. About a minute before our second break here, do you think there should be cameras in the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. It's preposterous that there are not.
And why isn't there?
Because they don't want them.
And why don't they want
them? Well, that's, Justice David Souter used to say that it'll be cameras over his dead body. I think, and Justice Scalia is very concerned that the media will take sound bites and distort. I think that the charitable description of why they don't want cameras is the justices are all very protective of the institution. They don't want a precipitous change that would somehow damage the court. Interestingly, Justice Kagan said in her confirmation hearings that she thought there should be cameras in the court. Now, after 2 years on the Supreme Court, she's starting to say, well, I'm not so sure. I just think they're very worried about the court's perception. But you know what? It's the public's business. And there are only about 200 seats in there. And in a modern age, to say that they are public simply because a handful of people can watch in person is just wrong. Now, I think what the court will do is they will move towards audio releases and audio broadcasts first. And that will prove unproblematic, and then they'll move towards video.
I'm all for that. Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Jeffrey Toobin about his new book called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Einstein Medical Center Montgomery supports WHYY. Opening late September in East Norriton, Einstein Medical Center Montgomery offers quiet, all-private rooms designed for patients' comfort and safety. Other features include a 24-hour emergency department staffed by board-certified physicians, cardiothoracic surgery, cancer care, orthopedic care, robotic and bariatric surgery, and a maternity unit equipped with a Level 3 neonatal intensive care unit. More information at 1-800-EINSTEIN or einsteinmontgomery.com.
More than 1 million kids drop out of school every year. That problem starts early and has long-lasting impacts.
It pretty much started with skipping class.
Once I turned 16, I was like, oh, finally, I'm really not going to school now.
I'm Andrea Seabrook. Join me for the public radio special, Left Behind, Dropping Out. Part of American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, tackling the high school dropout crisis, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Saturday at noon on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We live in a society much more open about sexual orientation, but what should parents know about helping their child figure out his or hers? Also, will Mad Men make Emmy history this Sunday? Will Breaking Bad break through? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Jeffrey Toobin, a former prosecutor who's been writing about legal affairs for The New Yorker for almost 20 years. He's a senior legal analyst at CNN and has been kept busy by the U.S. Supreme Court and a number of legal issues that have been bouncing around Congress and the country. And again, he's got a new book called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. And let me get John from media to join our conversation. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I think that we ought to keep in mind when we're examining President Obama's aggressiveness or lack of aggressiveness in making appointments to the federal district courts, that we should keep in mind the fact that any lawyer who gets appointed, that appointment will, of course, be met with a lot of publicity. That lawyer can look at his or her practice as effectively over. His partners or her partners will be wondering, is he going to be here 6 months from now? His or her clients are not going to want to entrust a case that lawyer is going to be needed to litigate within the next year, because that lawyer could be on his way or her way to the federal district court at any moment. This doesn't, and of course, these lawyers know that they're not going to be confirmed because the Senate is just not confirming anybody. Republican. Go ahead.
I mean, some will. I mean, some have been confirmed. I would add to your list of the difficulties confronting judicial nominees is that they are sacrificing their practice, they are sacrificing their privacy for a job that I believe now pays $170,000 a year. Now, you are not going to get a lot of sympathy from the broader general public for that's a good deal of money for people out there in the real world. However, among prominent and successful lawyers, it is a dramatic pay cut for almost all. And you know, it's just hard to attract people, especially in metropolitan areas like here in Philadelphia or New York, Washington, Los Angeles, where the cost of living is higher, and people who are of the age where you are eligible to be on the Supreme Court often have kids heading off to college. And so it is not a simple thing to get good people to put their names up, but Republicans have had a better time of it, and thanks to Ed Meese, a very unheralded figure, but I think a very important one, who said Republicans have to have strong views on judicial issues. He brought a lot of young conservatives to the bench. Obama has not followed suit.
Interesting. John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Linda from Tuckerton has to say. Linda, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I have a hard time with the concept that money is speech, because then that leads me to think, well, what of the people in this country who have no money?
Well, that's of the questions that hangs over
that,
this.
Absolutely. You know, I don't think the idea that money is speech is somehow irrational. I mean, picture a system where we said to Americans, no one is allowed to contribute at all to political campaigns, that political campaigns must be conducted entirely by individuals walking door to door. That has a First Amendment problem. I mean, it is true, I think, that the act of contributing to a campaign has some First Amendment implications. However, what Congress and the courts had said up to Citizens United is, yes, there is a First Amendment aspect to giving to a campaign, but it can be regulated. And I think what's so problematic about Citizens United is that taking the power to regulate away from the government essentially gives the power to the people who have all the money. And that's what's really problematic.
It's also created these sort of faux separate organizations that allegedly don't have any ties to the candidate
super
or a campaign.
PACs or 501c4 organizations. Those are doomed, I think, because the courts are going to say, this is just a fiction. But they're not going to say it's a fiction, so stop it. They're going to say it's a fiction, so let them give money directly to the campaigns.
That's where I think we're headed. Linda, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's get Graham from West Philadelphia to join us. Graham, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I would like to offer a civil libertarian perspective on the Citizens United issue. I agree with the court's decision that money is speech, and I don't think that I agree with Jeffrey that the direction the country is heading is to.
I think we've lost you, Graham. We don't have a great line, but it seems that he shares at least some of your perspective.
Absolutely,
on this.
And I think one of the problems, a lot of liberal folks are like they're so outraged that money is speech, and I try to make the point that there is an aspect of speech that involves spending money. If you were to ban people from spending any money to express their views, that would have big First Amendment problems, and that is a big civil liberties problem. The problem is it has always been subject to some regulation, and the courts have allowed that regulation. And without that regulation, the money, I think, really just overwhelms the speech.
Well, and as we were saying earlier, the more money you have under that system, the more speech slash influence you probably have as well.
Right. And to have a system where essentially one person, Sheldon Adelson, underwrote the entire Newt Gingrich campaign. Is that a system where is that a healthy system? And going back to Buckley versus Valeo, another thing that Buckley versus Valeo said is that candidates themselves can spend as much money as they want. So in the city where I live, New York, Michael Bloomberg spent $100 million to be elected mayor. Now, the one good thing is he doesn't owe his campaign contributors either, which is a problem. But isn't there some absurdity to a system that allows one person to spend $100 million to be elected mayor of a city?
Let me shift gears a bit because you have some interesting profiles of some of the justices on the Supreme Court, including Justice Ginsburg, someone, as I was telling you during the break, who has fascinated me because I know she's had to struggle with cancer. She looks like she's about weighs 80 pounds. She looks like a tiny, frail justice. But the way you describe her, she's not.
Fierce, powerful, linebacker-like strength in a body that is about 80 pounds. She really is that little. And also in demeanor, so different from Sandra Day O'Connor. Sandra Day O'Connor was an Arizona state senator, and she still has that outgoing air of the politician. She's tall, and she walks into a room, and she shakes everybody's hand. And Ruth Ginsburg sits in the corner in her white gloves, but do not be deceived.
Really?
And one of the stories in the book that I really I think is so interesting is how the Lilly Ledbetter case, which was a case about whether women could sue for sex discrimination and statute of limitations. And not only did Ginsburg write a dissenting opinion, but Ginsburg read from the bench a version of that dissenting opinion, which basically laid the whole problem in Congress's lap and said, Congress, you can fix this if you want to.
Hmm.
And Congress, which had just gotten into Democratic hands, got behind the issue, and it became a major plank of the Democratic platform. And the first bill that Barack Obama signed as President of the United States was the Lilly Ledbetter Act. And I have to say, it is a very emotional and wonderful thing to watch the YouTube video in the East Room of the White House of the President of the United States and Lilly Ledbetter, who sued Goodyear Tire and Rubber, walking down together. And you see Judge Joe Biden just bawling his eyes out. It's kind of a great thing, I have to say.
Love those little moments. You also write about Justice Thomas. And as people have said, he does, I don't know the last, has he ever spoken from the bench?
6.5 years ago was his last question.
Really?
February of 2006.
And since then has not said anything from the bench.
Not asked any questions.
But as you say, his influence is that he has introduced new ideas to his colleagues, that he seems to have influence behind the scenes, but certainly not
absolutely
from the bench.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think people have a very misleading sense of Justice Thomas because of his bizarre continuing silence on
and
the bench that he's some. Oh, yeah. I mean, there have been many justices, including several liberals like Marshall and Brennan, who didn't ask a lot of questions. But no one has ever gone even 1 year, much less 6.5 years, without asking a question. And but Thomas is not an isolated or unpopular or uninfluential figure at the court. When you look at issues like gun control and speech, corporate speech, it's really Thomas who's been the leading edge of making arguments that may have seemed out there at the beginning but have since become adopted. There are a lot of people condescend to Thomas and say, oh, he's just a second vote for Scalia. Not true
really?
At all.
Really?
Because he's more conservative than Scalia. I mean, there has not been as conservative a justice as Clarence Thomas since the 1930s on the Supreme Court. It is really a dramatic judicial philosophy, but one that is influential.
When the Affordable Care Act was being argued before the court, some said he should recuse himself because his wife was very active in the opposing and an active, I'm not sure, officially within the Tea Party movement, but nonetheless was a critic of the Affordable Care Act. You say no.
No, I say no. We live in a world of two career families. Ginni Thomas has been a political activist since before she married Clarence Thomas 25 years ago. She is someone, about 25 years ago. This is her job. Clarence Thomas was not going to make money if the Affordable Care Act was struck down. This is just something she felt. And I don't see any reason why justices or judges should have to recuse themselves just because their wives or husbands have opinions about issues. And I thought it was really just a transparent attempt by liberals to get a conservative vote off the court, and that's not right.
Interesting. Let me get, looks like Jeb from Maryland to join us on Radio Times. And Jeb, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was curious about what the process about justice of recusing himself would be, and more specifically in regards to Clarence Thomas, the Monsanto case where they're patenting life. I do understand that he once worked for that, he was a lawyer for Monsanto, and I was curious about whether he should have recused himself from that case. And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in.
The answer is the Supreme Court is unusual even within the federal system in that it operates on the honor system almost entirely. The justices have to decide whether they have a conflict of interest. And frankly, I think it's worked pretty well. I have not seen dramatic examples of conflicts where people should have recused themselves and did it. I thought that Justice Scalia was right not to recuse himself in a case involving Vice President Cheney, even though they had gone duck hunting together. Mm-hmm. It is true that Clarence Thomas, very early in his career, did work for Monsanto. But I don't think he owns any stock in the company anymore, and just because he worked for them a long time ago, I wouldn't think that would be grounds for recusal.
Would it be fair to say that justices are more public, I mean, either writing books or giving speeches or mixing it up with the public than they used to be?
Definitely.
What do you think that is?
Well, I think the times have changed, and I think the justices recognize that in an era where there is so much media attention and so many media outlets, they need to tell the country why the Supreme Court is important and what it does. And so you see, at least on the part of some justices, Justice Scalia has written a book, Justice Breyer has written several books, Justice Thomas wrote a memoir, Justice Sotomayor is working on a memoir. They are much more public figures than they used to be. That's not entirely without precedent in history. Justice William O. Douglas wrote a lot of books while he was on the court and was a pretty outspoken political figure, but he was very much more the exception than the rule in those days.
You say something about the Democrats. They have a pallid embrace of the status quo. Conversely, Republican judicial agenda is for change.
Absolutely. I mean, that to me is the theme of the oath, the difference between Roberts and Obama. You know, Democrats, they want, you know, Roe v. Wade to be left alone. They want sort of affirmative action to be allowed. But it is not a big part of the Democratic agenda. You know, you go to a Tea Party rally, and they're all talking about the Constitution. They're all saying that the Commerce Clause needs to be restricted, that there's no such thing as a right to privacy. And they may be right, they may be wrong. I think they're largely wrong on their issues. But they are talking about the Constitution, and it matters to them. And I think that is a much more effective way to make your case in the United States. And if you look at the Bush-Reagan judicial appointees, they are much more aggressive in pushing that view than the Democratic judicial appointees have been.
Does President Obama do President Obama and Chief Justice John Roberts, do they have a relationship?
Not really. Their paths do not cross. Both of them are, one of Barack Obama's rules when he became president was no new friends. And when he socializes with people, it tends to be with his friends from Chicago. John Roberts socializes with the people he served in the Reagan administration with. Those are his sort of core friends. Their paths really do not cross very often, but they are both creatures of the meritocracy. They were both top of their class, figuratively and literally, and I think they recognize the quality of the intellect of the other, and they have a respectful wariness of each other.
We're almost out of time here, but you describe when Barack Obama is becoming president, going to the court, and someone says something about shooting hoops. Does the Supreme Court have a basketball court?
It has what's known as the highest court in the land.
Really?
Absolutely.
I wasn't sure if you were just being clever.
No, that is not a metaphor. There is a basketball court on the top. And one of the rules at the Supreme Court is you can't play while the court is in session because you can distantly hear the bouncing
really?
Of the ball in the courtroom.
And can anyone play there, or is it just for members of the court?
Just for members of the court, although Justice O'Connor, in one of her path-breaking, she brought an aerobics class to the clause.
The
women did aerobics there, still do.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Nice
Marty.
To have you with us as well. And the book is called The Oath, and it's subtitled The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, and Jonathan Best helping us out this week. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.